Hello there. My name is Greg, and I'm a reader with the Tonking Information Center. For the next 60 minutes, I will be reading you the news headlines from the BBC World News for Tuesday, August 18th, 2026. So, hard to believe we're more than halfway through August, heading towards the Labor Day weekend and the traditional end of summer. I myself love fall. It's one of my favorite seasons. How about you? What is your favorite season? Well, while you're thinking about that, we're going to jump into the news. As usual, there's a lot going on throughout the world, and we're going to see how many stories we can cover, how many parts of the world we can visit over the next 60 minutes. The headline of the first story reads, Carney's final chance to convince Trump as U.S.-Canada trade deadline looms. Intense trade talks are going down to the wire as Canada seeks to avoid a fresh round of tariffs from the Trump administration due to come into effect on Wednesday. Canadian negotiators have been camped out in Washington for a week, trying to pin down some agreement before new 50% tariffs on some $20 billion worth of Canadian imports are imposed. Prime Minister Mark Carney kept details of the talks close to his chest when pressed by reporters on Monday, saying that given the very delicate and intense negotiations, it is not the time to negotiate in public. He and Trump spoke by phone on Monday afternoon about the talks, his office confirmed to the BBC. While Carney told reporters that Canada was negotiating from a position of strength, the stakes are high for the Prime Minister and his team to reach a deal before the Trump administration's latest financial squeeze on about 5% of all Canadian imports takes hold. Despite a flurry of meetings between Canadian negotiators and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer in recent days, the two sides have yet to reach a final agreement. Our job is not yet done, U.S.-Canada Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc said on Monday as he left Greer's office. Both sides have been clear the talks have been tough. Trump has described Canada as nasty on trade, a characterization of negotiations that Carney did not entirely dispute. He has also warned that the time to get tougher will be if the countries fail to reach a deal. Even if one is reached, Carney will need to sell any concessions made to a public frustrated with and skeptical of the administration south of the border. He will also need the buy-in from the provinces on any compromises. Excuse me. The U.S. has been asking for a number of concessions from Canada, including removing its remaining retaliatory tariffs on American autos and adjusting its dairy quotas. It has also asked for a ban for the ban on U.S. alcohol sales imposed early last year by most Canadian provinces in retaliation for Trump's tariffs to be removed. That concession would depend on the agreement of the provinces which are in control of the alcohol in their respective jurisdictions. Ontario Premier Doug Ford, who makes a point of being tough on the U.S., said last week that an agreement on booze was conditional. Canada has been in pursuit of a deal that would see the U.S. drop or reduce tariffs on its steel, aluminum, automobile, and lumber sectors, all of which have been damaging to the country's economy. If we get a fair deal that will protect our steel sector, our auto sector, our forestry sector, our agriculture sector, our manufacturing sector, then we'd be happy to bring booze back on the shelves, Ford said. Carney could also face pushback on any concessions on dairy, especially in Quebec, where the Premier, Christine Frechette, has said supply management is non-negotiable. Trump argues the system, which has production quotas, set pricing, and import quotas on dairy, eggs, and poultry, is unreasonable to American farmers who want to sell their products north of the border. The White House unveiled the new tariffs on July 20th, saying in a fact sheet that they would become effective in 30 days' time, which is Wednesday, August 19th. Canadians are also not in the mood to offer many concessions to the U.S., even as they want more stability. A new poll from the Abacus Data indicates that 74% feel the trade dispute has had an impact on their households, and 36% want to see Canada respond with new counter-tariffs, even if it risks more domestic economic pain. Just 18% favor concessions like ending provincial bans on American alcohol in order to remove or reduce U.S. tariffs. Reports in Canadian media also suggested that Canada's chief negotiator, Janice Charette, warned her U.S. counterparts that the new tariffs could put further trade negotiations at risk if they are enacted on Wednesday. Carney has said he would not sign a deal unless it's a good one for Canada, though he has not been clear on what such a deal would look like. On Monday, he only said, "We will have opportunities over the next 48 hours to discuss in more detail as the negotiations go forward." He added that he had plans for any situations that may arise should the talks fail. Conservative trade critic Shivaloy Majumdar said in a statement that it's time for a measure of relief from economic anxiety. "We have grown tired of seeing our country used as a punching bag," he said, "yet we share a common hope that Prime Minister Carney will deliver a genuine win at the negotiating table." Well, that remains to be seen. It'll be very interesting. Let's see. Here's a story. The headline reads, The UK supports Ukraine 100%, Burnham says, after Russia's drone warning. Prime Minister Andy Burnham has said that the UK will continue to support Ukraine 100% after Moscow warned of consequences following confirmation that British-made drones were used in recent Ukrainian strikes in Russia. "We are not fair-weather fans, friends. We will be there in Ukraine's hour of need, and that will not change," said Burnham. The Russian embassy to the UK earlier accused Britain of deliberately opting for an escalation of the Ukraine crisis, adding that the deeper its involvement in the conflict, the higher the price it will pay. Ukraine has stepped up attacks on Moscow and elsewhere deep inside Russia, particularly targeting oil refineries and logistics sites for its key online retailer, Wildberries. Asked about the Russian threat, the Prime Minister maintained the UK was providing support so that Ukraine can defend itself, and that's been the British position all the way through this conflict by previous prime ministers, and it remains the case with me. Russia has warned the UK in the past over its role in providing Ukraine with drone technology as well as Storm Shadow missiles. The Russian embassy said London's actions will inevitably carry consequences for which it will have to answer, but it did not elaborate on the type of threat Moscow was considering. The latest phase of the war has directly affected Russia's domestic fuel supplies and dented the Russian economy. The UK has been among Ukraine's biggest international supporters since Russia launched its full-scale invasion in February of 2022. The Ministry of Defense said the UK was committed to providing the equipment Ukraine needs to defend itself against Russian President Vladimir Putin's illegal invasion. Russia currently controls approximately a fifth of Ukrainian territory, but its forces have had very little success on the front line for months. Nevertheless, casualties have continued to mount behind the front lines. United Nations officials say last month's civilian death toll of 437 people in Ukraine was the highest since May of 2022. In Russia, a foreign ministry spokesperson told the TASS news agency on Tuesday that in the past week, 69 people, including three children, had been killed. In the latest Russian attacks on Ukraine, 17 people have been killed, including 10 in the village of Peshenihi in northeastern Ukraine early on Tuesday. Private homes, a cafe, and a post office were hit as two missiles claimed the lives of the 10 villagers. Elsewhere, three Ukrainians died in Sumy, two in Zaporizhia, and two in Kherson. Moscow's warning to the UK comes after a wave of Ukrainian strikes on Russia. Five people were killed in a residential area of the Rostov region in the south of the country over the weekend. Hundreds of drones have been launched by Ukrainian forces toward the Moscow region in the past 2 days alone. Regional Governor Andrei Vorobyov said on Tuesday that a 10-year-old girl was hurt and a Wild Berries warehouse was damaged. As well as deploying imported drones, Ukraine has been able to use homegrown drone and missile technology in recent weeks, including its FP-5 Flamingo cruise missile. Two British companies are known to have built drones supplied to Kiev. A military source confirmed to the BBC that Ukraine drones had been used in recent attacks on Russia, which are said to have caused more than 35 million pounds in economic damage. In April, the UK Defense Ministry announced it would supply Ukraine with tens of thousands of drones, including long-range strike devices, in its biggest package of military aid so far. Andy Burnham told Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky when they visited a British naval base late last month that he can count on the UK for as long as it takes. Burnham also said the UK would share its new Stone Cloak technology with Kiev, which would enable electronic jamming of Russian air defenses. Russia has long complained of the use of UK drone technology in the war. In 2024, a foreign ministry spokesperson said drones using UK components and configurations were used to attack Russian territory, including a fuel depot in the Kamensky district of the Rostov region. In the latest Ukrainian attacks, overnight, Russian officials said some 620 drones had been flown toward the region surrounding Moscow. Russian air defenses destroyed more than 180 of the drones, but several people were wounded. On Saturday night, Ukraine fired some 822 drones toward Russia, with 600 aiming for Moscow, according to its regional governor, who said the Russian capital had suffered one of the most massive drone attacks in recent memory. 7 deaths were reported across Russia. Much of the focus on Russian threats toward the Ukraine's Western allies has been on hybrid warfare. Although incidents are rarely confined as Russian-sponsored, numerous cases have been numerous cases have been reported around Europe involving drones flying close to sensitive military and industrial sites. Last week, German officials warned of a very acute risk from hybrid attacks after a drone landed with explosives was defused close to a Ukrainian cargo plane at Leipzig Airport, which acts as a military hub for Germany and its NATO allies. That's a little update on what is going on in regard to the UK's support of the Ukraine. This is a horrible story from Greece. The headline reads, a British couple on a honeymoon is killed in a helicopter crash on a Greek island. A young British couple and their pilot were killed in a helicopter crash on the Greek island of Sifnos on Monday, Greek police have said. They have been named as newlyweds Alexander Cromie and Marie Ebert, who were in Greece on their honeymoon. The private helicopter crashed just meters from a landing pad, killing the pair and their pilot, a Greek national. The couple are said to have taken the helicopter from the village of Markopoulou near Athens to the popular holiday island Kathimerini, reported. Greece's aviation safety authority told the BBC it was investigating the crash and that its investigators were heading to the scene on Tuesday to gather evidence and speak to witnesses. A Foreign Office spokesperson told the BBC, our thoughts are with the families during this difficult time. We are providing consular support and are in contact with Greek authorities. The BBC has contacted Greek authorities and the aviation company for comment. Asset management firm Blackstone, where Cromie worked, said in a statement, we are shocked by the tragic passing of 3 people, including our colleague Alex Cromie and his wife Marie Ebert, who were celebrating on their honeymoon. Alex was beloved by everyone who knew and worked with him at Blackstone, and our thoughts and prayers are with his loved ones. A senior police official told the Times that the crash came down just before the helicopter's scheduled landing time of 18:15 local time. Sifnos Deputy Mayor Manolis Foundoukalos arrived at the scene shortly after the incident and told the local news site there was almost nothing left of the aircraft. He said locals saw the helicopter crash within meters of their homes and had described a bizarre engine noise coming from the aircraft as it was about to land. He said two of the victims were found in the wreckage while the third was found a short distance away. Firefighters worked to tackle the blaze, which broke out after the crash, and the flames had been extinguished by Monday morning. So, tragic story to come out of Greece. It's a interesting story. The headline reads, Hayden Panettiere, A Life of Struggles Alongside Screen Success. So Hayden Panettiere, who has died at the age of 36, lived most of her life in the spotlight, from success as a child star to lead roles in hit TV shows Heroes in Nashville, but also endured struggles that went along with the pressures of fame. Panettiere appeared in her first commercial when she was 11 months old. Her mother, Leslie Vogel, was an actress and set her daughter on the same path. By the age of 4, Hayden was in U.S. TV show One Life to Live, then at 8 joined another soap opera, The Guiding Light. Her natural acting ability was evident, but the burgeoning childhood career came at a cost. From a very young age, I lost the chance to have a normal childhood, friends, relationships, and my privacy, Panettiere wrote in her revealing autobiography, This Is Me, which was published earlier this year. She was groomed to be an actor, she told The Hollywood Reporter. I was like a little soldier, and I always have been. No was never an option. Panettiere's career flourished, and she soon earned roles, like the voice of Princess Dot in Pixar's A Bug's Life in 1998, becoming one of the youngest ever Grammy Award nominees for the accompanying children's read-along album. She starred with Denzel Washington in American football drama Remember the Titans in 2000 and had roles in TV's Ally McBeal in 2004's Raising Helen with Kate Hudson. When filming 2005's Racing Stripes, a child's film about a zebra who thinks it's a racehorse, she suffered a back injury when she fell off a zebra, and over 20 years later, these injuries still bother me, she wrote. She also starred in 2006 cheerleading comedy Bring It On, All or Nothing, the third installment in the Bring It On film series. Also in 2006, she achieved a new level of fame when mysterious TV drama Heroes became a major hit. Panettiere gave a likably sparky performance as Claire, a cheerleader who regenerated if she was physically harmed and who was at the heart of the show's Save the Cheerleader, Save the World plot. The actress was 17 when it launched, and the fame came with new levels of attention, including from swarms of paparazzi. They kicked her and said appalling things to attempt to get a reaction, she said, while one headline trumpeted a picture of her apparent cellulite. I suffered from body dysmorphia for years because of that, believing that no matter how strong, thin, or young I was, there was no escaping the dreaded cottage cheese thighs. At one point, she was given a happy pill by a publicist to help her perform on a red carpet. That ended up being the gateway drug that ushered me toward the good of pharmaceuticals and the downfall of addiction, she said. While working on Heroes, Panettiere suggested her mother should no longer be her manager. I desperately wanted her to just be my mom, the actress said. I also wasn't expecting the reaction that I got, which was, you owe me. That's all she said. And she walked out. During her career in Hollywood, Panettiere was also subjected to sexual harassment. At a party in 2008, a TV executive kissed her on the lips. She initially brushed the incident off as harmless, but Milo Ventimiglia, her Hero's co-star, who she started dating when she was 18, told her it was completely inappropriate. Later, a man who she described as an Oscar-winning actor and director allegedly exposed himself to her. She said he told her he had gum on his trousers, and When she looked down, this well-respected award-winning actor's testicles were hanging out from his unzipped fly. And another time, someone she thought of as a friend ushered her into a bed with a naked, unnamed, famous 30-something British singer-songwriter while on a yacht. "My body no longer felt like my own," Panettiere said. "The shock was so great it didn't even occur to me to say no." She did, however, manage to get out of the bed and run out of the room. Panettiere met Ukrainian boxing champion Volodymyr Klitschko at a party in Los Angeles when she was 19, and they began a relationship. He was 13 years older than her, and they had a daughter 5 years later. After the birth, she was hit hard by postpartum depression. "I never felt any hostility or negativity toward my child, thankfully, but I wasn't connecting with her the way I knew I should be, and I was full of stress and anxiety all the time," she told podcaster Jay Shetty. "She was drinking heavily. What I was doing to suppress those emotions was not normal, and it was not healthy." Klitschko helped her get treatment, but when their daughter was 3, he told Panettiere he was worried about the girl when she was with her mother because of her drinking, and asked her to sign over custody. Panettiere reacted angrily and considered a legal battle to keep their daughter, but eventually agreed because she accepted that her daughter, Kaya, needed to feel at rest, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally. She wrote, "Not being under the same roof with her every day has been the most gut-wrenching experience of my life, and it's hard to describe the layers of emotion, including sadness, resentment, and anger I felt because of it." Sorry about that. "I grieve that I am not the mother I thought I would be, and definitely not the mother I want to be. Trust me, no one should ever have to raise a child on FaceTime." She remained involved in her daughter's life and added in her recent autobiography that despite it all, the bond I have with Kaya is incredibly strong. At the same time, Panettiere was being lauded for playing troubled country singer Juliette Barnes in the TV drama Nashville, which earned her 2 Golden Globe nominations during its 6-year run. One critic in Metro wrote, "A character who could be the biggest stereotype going has, thanks to Panettiere's award-winning performance, become the heart of Nashville, a believably flawed, not always easy-to-like character who is clearly a product of her traumatic childhood." The distinction between the actress and her character became blurred, however. "When I first started doing Nashville, I thought, well, it's just a coincidence that our lives have so many similarities," she said. "And then as the years went on, the episodes went on, and everything kept matching up, from who Juliette Barnes was dating, to being an alcoholic, to postpartum depression, to losing her child, basically abandoning her child, and then it was like, okay, you guys are just mirroring my life." As well as being uncanny for Panettiere, it was traumatic to act out things so similar to her real life. "I dove headfirst into my own hell," she wrote. "I was suffering from debilitating anxiety and addiction. I couldn't shake, and I had to live through it twice, first at home as Hayden, and then in front of millions at home as Juliet." Shortly before Nashville finished filming, she met a new boyfriend, Brian Hickerson. He later turned violent with Panettiere, saying he would hit her head against the wall and on one occasion beat her face so badly she didn't leave her house for weeks. In 2021, he was jailed after pleading no contest to domestic abuse charges. Panettiere returned to acting after a 5-year break in 2023 in Scream 6, but suffered another major personal trauma the same year when her younger brother Jansen died, reportedly due to an enlarged heart. She had to face more difficulties than most in her 36 years and attempted to process them by writing her book, which was published in May. "I've always strived to be a positive person, but I grieve all the hours I've lost to addiction, my broken relationships, and my loved ones who are no longer here," she explained. "I also know I'm not alone when I say that the fact my family fell apart still stings. I've spent years in treatment trying to make sense of these losses, and I've concluded that the only thing I can change is myself and the person I want to be. if only it was that easy. She ended by telling readers she had accepted her past and had hopes for her future, having learned to walk hand in hand with my triumphs and my tragedies because they have made me who I am. Wow, it's quite an interesting story from this actress, Hayden Panettiere, who died over the weekend at age 36. Really, really sad to read and to listen to, I'm sure. This headline reads, the IVF staff accused of misleading UK parents about sperm and egg donors in northern Cyprus. At least 30 children, most of them British, are feared to have been conceived by IVF treatment in northern Cyprus using the wrong sperm or egg donors. In each case, the parents suspect they did not get the donors they had selected. The feature is one of several new findings in a BBC investigation that earlier this year uncovered the first 7 cases. All the parents say they carefully selected anonymous donors based on information such as their medical history, appearance, personality, education, and hobbies. However, they have concerns the requested sperm and egg donors may not have been used in their fertility treatments. Half of the 30 children were born from procedures at one clinic, Dugas IVF Center. It is absolutely scandalous, said one of the mothers, Rachel, who recently learned she received the wrong sperm donor from the clinic. 3 people, Dr. Ferdevs Uguz-Tip, Dr. Sevket Alpturk, and a patient coordinator, Julie Hodson, were involved in the care of many of these patients at Dugas. Parents suspect that members of the staff may have misled them. Ferdevs denies any wrongdoing, and neither Alpturk or Hodson have responded to our questions. The BBC has also now learned that the world's largest sperm bank, Cryos International, has blacklisted Dugas Clinic since 2016. In northern Cyprus, a territory where European Union laws do not apply and which is only legally recognized by Turkey, clinics are loosely regulated and promise patients low prices, high success rates, and a wide choice of sperm and egg donors. The Turkish-occupied territory is one of the most popular destinations for British people seeking fertility treatment abroad. We first revealed the emerging scandal in March, where a small group of parents appeared to have been misled about their donors. Responding to the allegations, the territory's Ministry of Health said it had launched an official investigation. However, it has not responded to our repeated requests for more information. Since then, more parents have reached out to us, and their stories have concerning similarities. The majority said the clinics they had used had promised them screened healthy donors from Western Europe, but they had become suspicious after their children were born. 11 of the 30 children have now taken commercial DNA tests, which show they have an inherited genetic ancestry from Turkey or surrounding countries. This suggests their parents' requested donors were not used. The majority of the children who have done DNA tests were conceived through IVF between 2012 and 2024 at the Dugas Clinic. Families have been left with more questions about who their children's real donors are and their medical histories. These reports are deeply troubling, said Laura Brydens, the founder of the charity Donor Conceived UK. It's a fundamental human right for a donor-conceived person to know the truth about their origins. Rachel says she spent years questioning whether she had been given the wrong sperm donor during her treatment at Dugas IVF Center. After reading our first article, she and her doctor-conceived son, Jonah 13, decided to do DNA tests, and the results indicated her fears were justified. I used to think the clinic had made a one-off mistake, she said. But now, after we told her about more families coming forward, she said it feels like this is something much bigger and more deceitful. Rachel chose Dugas in 2012 because of a helpful and friendly patient coordinator called Julie Hodson, whose role was to liaise between Rachel and Dr. Ferdevs Uguz-Tip, known professionally as Dr. Ferdevs, who was carrying out her treatment. Rachel, who was 39 at the time, needed a sperm donor so her eggs could be fertilized in a lab to create an embryo which could then be implanted into her uterus. The IVF package cost about £4,000, significantly cheaper than similar treatment in the UK, and included donor sperm from the world's largest sperm bank, Cryos International, in Denmark. Rachel selected an anonymous Danish sperm donor on the Cryos website, known as Ditto. On his profile, he stated he would be happy for any of his offspring to find out his identity when they turned 18. "I wanted any child of mine to have the choice of being able to contact the donor," said Rachel. "For a child trying to figure out who they are in the world, it could be really important." So, story goes on and on and on, but I think you get the gist of it. It's a horrible situation there for people finding out that their egg or sperm donors are not who they had selected them to be. This headline reads, "Kariba ferry death toll rises to 93, making it Zimbabwe's deadliest transport disaster." I think we read about this story last week. The death toll from a ferry disaster on Zimbabwe's Lake Kariba has risen to 93, which makes it the country's deadliest transport disaster, according to the state-run Herald newspaper. The ferry had a capacity to carry 90 passengers, but the paper estimates at least 168 people were actually on board when it was hit by a strong wave and overturned a week ago. President Emmerson Mnangagwa declared a state of disaster following the accident, and search and recovery efforts are continuing by divers. The lake, which straddles the border with Zambia, is one of the world's largest man-made reservoirs, supporting transport and fishing and providing vital hydroelectric power to both countries. The death toll rose from 44 at the time of the accident to 84 over the weekend. 9 more bodies have since been found by divers, and a police statement on Tuesday put the death toll at 93. The bodies were now being recovered further away from the scene of the sinking, some of them drifting towards Zambia, the Herald reports. Provincial Affairs Minister Marion Chumbo said 67 people had been rescued after the sinking. But she added that it was proving difficult to identify some of the recovered bodies, with relatives having to rely on clothes and other items to do so. "We are running out of time, and DNA may now be needed to assist in the identification process," the minister was quoted by the Herald as saying. The police said 83 of the victims had so far been identified, 39 of whom were children. A vital and cheap transport link for rural communities, the ferry was carrying parents taking their children home for the school holidays and traders, the Herald said. One survivor in her 40s told the AFP news agency that the ferry had been particularly overloaded at the time, with goods and passengers had raised concerns about the rough conditions. The life jackets were buried under the luggage, and not more than 30 people managed to get them, said Itaya Maramusa, a trader from the Mola village. "Children are screaming, and most of the passengers were vomiting, but the captain didn't seem to care." A local councillor representing Mola, Tite Busami, told the Herald it was a difficult time for his community, with children in particular affected. "We have distressing cases where a child lost both parents and other siblings, leaving them as the only surviving member of the family," he is quoted as saying. The councillor who lost a child in the accident said other families were still awaiting news of those believed to have been on the ferry. Just a horrible story coming out of that tragedy. Interesting headline here. We'll take a look at this. Its headline reads, "What it's like to be on a warship like the USS Abraham Lincoln." U.S. Navy veteran Johnny Burnell spent 111 days aboard the battleship USS Vinson during the U.S. war with Afghanistan in 2001. His role as a Navy photographer allowed him to visit crew throughout the ship, unlike most sailors who are confined to parts of the vessel where they work. In an age before digital photography, troops were often eager to get their pictures snapped whenever they saw him. Over more than 3 months aboard the USS Carl Vinson, he witnessed a change among the crew as their excitement and energy faded to what he called a sadness. There was one point where there was a visible kind of deadness in the shipmates' eyes, he recalls. I still think the hardest part of my job was watching the sadness in people's faces every frickin' day. Burnell told the BBC he has been watching on the brink of tears as concerns mount about conditions aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, which has been deployed as part of the U.S.-Iran war since December 11th, more than double his deployment aboard the Vinson. Military on the Lincoln are reportedly contending with food shortages, broken plumbing, and exhaustion, according to two U.S. publications that cover the Military Times and the Stars and Stripes. Family members of sailors on board have expressed concern about their mental health deteriorating due to the conditions, with some sailors having reportedly attempted to jump overboard. Military officials have disputed that there are severe issues afflicting the ship, and some veterans have also suggested that the accounts in the media are overblown. The reports in the media are largely inaccurate and 99% hype, said retired Navy Lieutenant Commander Steve Rogers, the director of the Association of the United States Navy. As part of his job for the association, a nonprofit that works to help U.S. Navy service members, he has been speaking to relatives of troops on the Lincoln. He says it's normal for families to worry about their loved ones at war and that the troops are well prepared for the situation they find themselves in. In an interview with the BBC, a relative of one sailor on the Lincoln said that their family member had lost 65 pounds, 29 kilos, and has been suffering from exhaustion because of the constant noise and vibrations. Asked about the situation aboard the Lincoln on Friday, Trump dismissed the reports, saying the deployment is not nearly long enough. On Sunday, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees operations in the Middle East, released a statement saying that of the 11 active aircraft carriers in the U.S. military, the Lincoln currently has among the lowest number of cases related to mental health. That doesn't mean it's all perfect, said Admiral Brad Cooper, adding that service at sea for long periods is not for everyone. It is uniquely challenging and tough, he continued, adding that mental health is another aspect of individual health and requires our attention, just like physical health and spiritual health. Burnell, the former military photographer, says from his prior experience, he believes many members of the crew aboard the Lincoln don't get the chance to even visit the top deck due to their duties below. These troops can go long periods without seeing the sky. One colleague on the USS Vinson, which Burnell described as a floating prison, did everything he could to get kicked off, including selling drugs and starting an underground rave club, he says. In Burnell's tiny bed, which troops referred to as coffin racks, there was no room to turn over, and the cables that catch and slow aircrafts as they land ran through a wall right behind his head. It was just nonstop noise. The ship is just always loud, he says. Planes are always coming or taking off, and guns are always firing, he adds. It remains unclear what the conditions on the Lincoln are like now. A crew from CNN visited last month and did not discover any widespread issues during 3 days on board. Several troops mentioned being forced to ration food and losing weight over many months, but when CNN boarded on July 7th, food was plentiful, the outlet reported. Showers were also hot, although there were some signs of mold. The U.S. has deployed another battleship to relieve the Lincoln, which should arrive in the Middle East in another week. The replacement ship, the USS George Washington, has had its own history of mental health challenges. In 2022, a spate of suicides aboard the ship while it was still docked at a port in Virginia led to a military inspector's investigation. The conclusion of the investigation found the deaths were not caused by any one issue, but were the result of several problems related to poor living conditions. The report released in May of 2023 found that the Navy's top brass had let our standards slip, and in doing so, we let our people down. Dr. Harold Kudler, the former head of mental health for the U.S. Veterans Administration, says the issue has been studied by the U.S. government for many years. Kudler says the isolation of being aboard a ship with moments of prolonged boredom followed by extreme alertness can amplify mental health struggles. You don't know where the front is, he says, describing the situation aboard the Lincoln, especially in this kind of asynchronistic war we are seeing. These factors can be overwhelming for both enlisted troops and officers as well. So, interesting story about life on a warship. Let's see, there's an update on another story I know we've read about in the past. The headline reads, Mushroom Murderer Aaron Patterson is appealing, and here's what you need to know. Excuse me. A year after her blockbuster trial, Australia's notorious mushroom murderer is facing court again in a bid to overturn her conviction. Aaron Patterson was jailed for life last September for murdering three relatives and trying to kill another with a toxic mushroom meal she served at her home in Leongatha, Victoria, in 2023. But the 51-year-old says she didn't receive a fair trial, citing problems with evidence, the actions of the prosecution, and an unusual mishap with the jury while they deliberated on their verdicts. At the same time that Aaron Patterson's case is heard, prosecutors will also be appealing her sentence. The judge said that Patterson could apply for parole after 33 years, but the prosecution says that's manifestly inadequate and the triple murderer should never be freed. What did she do? Well, Patterson killed her in-laws, Don and Gail Patterson, both 70, and Gail's sister, Heather Wilkinson, 66, after serving them individual portions of beef Wellington containing death cap mushrooms at her home in rural Victoria in 2023. Her husband, Ian Wilkinson, a local pastor, survived the lunch after weeks in the hospital and still has ongoing health issues related to the poisoning. Patterson's estranged husband, Simon Patterson, was meant to attend the lunch, but he canceled at the last minute, in part due to his belief that his wife had repeatedly tried to poison him over several years. After the trial, it was revealed that he had become so violently ill after eating several of her meals in the past that he had been in a coma, a large part of his bowel had been surgically removed, and his family were told to say goodbye to him twice as he was not expected to survive his ailments. Aaron Patterson maintained throughout the trial that she never meant to kill her relatives, that it was all a terrible accident, and her lies and attempts to dispose of evidence in the aftermath of the lunch were because she was panicking she would be blamed for their deaths. Patterson won't be attending the appeal in person. She has chosen to appear via video link from Dame Phyllis Frost Center, the maximum security prison on the outskirts of Melbourne where she has been serving her sentence. Last November, her legal team filed a 3-page document outlining the arguments they plan to make in an effort to overturn her conviction. There are 7 grounds for this appeal, which will be heard by 3 judges. Firstly, there are bits of evidence. Excuse me. Firstly, there are bits of evidence Patterson's lawyers say the jurors should never have seen. For example, mobile phone tracking data that indicated she had traveled to places where death cap mushrooms were recently spotted. Her lawyers argue that evidence from Facebook friends should not have been allowed. That included online messages in which she ranted about her in-laws as well as her estranged husband, Simon Patterson, at one point calling him a deadbeat. All that evidence, Patterson's team says, was not relevant and prejudicial, carrying a substantial miscarriage of justice. But her lawyers argue that other pieces of evidence would have helped Patterson in court. Photos and images relating to her hobby as a longtime mushroom forager, and supporting their argument that deaths were a tragic accident, had been wrongly excluded, the defense says. Then there are issues with the prosecution. Patterson's team say they were inconsistent about a motive, starting the trial by saying they wouldn't argue a particular motive, by ending it by implying there was one. They also criticized the 5 days that Patterson was cross-examined by barrister Nanette Rogers. At times it felt tense witnessing the two sparring in the courtroom, with Rogers accusing her of repeatedly lying. Patterson argues it was unfair and oppressive. But the most intriguing aspect of the appeal document submitted by Aaron Patterson's lawyers relates to the jury deliberations. Because there was so much hype around the case, there were steps taken throughout the trial to ensure the jury wasn't influenced by friends, family, or the media. When they began deliberating, they had to stay in supervised accommodations with little to no contact with the outside world until they reached a decision. But, according to Patterson's lawyers, a fundamental irregularity occurred which fatally undermined the integrity of the verdicts. It turns out that room shortages caused by the media frenzy in the regional towns around the courthouse meant the jury wound up sharing a hotel with members of the prosecution, a key police witness, and journalists. The jury had a whole hotel floor to themselves, and the judge at the time said there was no evidence they had any interaction with anyone linked to the case. Patterson's team didn't raise any concerns during the trial, but in their appeal filing said, "This requires the quashing of the convictions and an order for a retrial so that justice cannot only be done, but be seen to be done." The Department of Public Prosecution is appealing over the length of Patterson's sentence. Justice Christopher Bale last year agreed that Patterson's crimes were the worst of their kind, but said his decision to allow parole after 33 years was influenced by the harsh prison conditions she faced. He noted that she had already spent 15 months in solitary confinement at the time of her sentencing. In solitary confinement, prisoners cannot mix, and meals are delivered via a small opening in the cell door. For her own safety, he added, there was a substantial chance that she would be held in an isolation wing for years to come because of the notoriety of her case. The outcome of the appeal will not be known immediately after these hearings, as the decision could take months. If the three judges in the Court of Appeal choose to overturn her convictions, there are two options, a retrial or an acquittal. If the prosecution's appeal is successful, Aaron Patterson could see her parole period being extended beyond 33 years, or she may even be sentenced to life without parole. So there you go. That's a little update on the mushroom murderer from Australia who accidentally poisoned her in-laws and her sister and tried to poison her then-husband after trying apparently several times to poison her ex-husband. So I'd be a little nervous if your wife suggests mushrooms for dinner tonight. You might want to hold off on that. Let's see what we've got here. That's an interesting headline. I'm not sure what it's about. The headline reads, OpenAI makes ChatGPT less human for teens in a new safety update. The maker of ChatGPT is rolling out a range of new safety features today for under 18s who use the AI chatbot. Those with new teen accounts will be able to switch off the human voice response in order to minimize the tech's ability to appear like a person. OpenAI is also introducing regular reminders for young people to take a break from using the tool, reminding them that ChatGPT is AI and saying it can wait. The firm insisted this was not in response to a particular issue with children believing ChatGPT to be alive, but there are growing concerns about people becoming convinced that the AI tools they interact with are sentient. Last year, Mustafa Suleiman, the head of AI at rival firm Microsoft, said seemingly conscious AI products kept him awake at night because he was so worried about their impact on society. In other areas, OpenAI seemed to be loosely following the teen account model developed by the large social networks. In a blog post announcing the GPT chat for teens, the firm said teenagers' use of AI should come with protections that reflect their developmental stage, reinforce real-world relationships, and support healthy use over time. It said teen accounts would become the default for those who identified themselves as teenagers when they signed up, and others whom the firm itself identified as under 18. But it did not elaborate on how it would identify those teens. Under 13s are not allowed to use the product. Last year, ChatGPT launched study mode for students in which it talks through schoolwork without giving away the answers. Young people will now be able to set study mode hours during which this will be the default setting. They will also be able to activate quiet times when the tool will be switched off for them. OpenAI says of the young people who use ChatGPT, 9 out of 10 use it to help them with learning. A report released yesterday by the Policy Exchange think tank claimed that the majority of UK universities are leaving themselves exposed to students enhancing their grades by using AI, relying on online exams completed remotely. It said 94% of the students it spoke to admitted to using the tech in assessments. OpenAI is also adding eating disorder-themed prompts to a list of harmful user requests which will be flagged to parents with linked accounts. The company said each alert would be reviewed by a human before it was sent, and it aimed to have them with parents within an hour of the request being made. In its blog, OpenAI said it would focus on moments when offline support may matter the most. So far, there is no bespoke AI regulation in the UK. The government under former Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer considered restricting AI chatbots for under-18s alongside its other reforms on social media use by children. Anthropic's AI tool Claude is still for adults only. But when Google first launched its Gemini AI tool, initially called Bard, it also did not allow children to use it. Dr. Susan Shelmurn, a medical imaging doctor at Great Dr. Susan Shelmurn, a medical imaging doctor at Great Ormond Street Hospital and an AI academic, told the BBC last year that one day doctors may start asking patients how much they use AI in the same way that they currently ask about smoking and drinking habits. We already know what ultra-processed foods can do to the body, and this is ultra-processed information. We're going to get an avalanche of ultra-processed minds. Interesting topic. And one in which parents certainly have to take a look at what their kids are doing. This is kind of in the similar field. This article headline reads, the U.S. states call for big changes to Instagram and Facebook as Meta child privacy trial begins. Meta has been hit with successive losses in court over how its platforms have targeted and harmed young users, but a jury trial set to begin on Tuesday may pose the biggest threat yet to its operations. The trial stems from a lawsuit filed in 2023 by 29 U.S. states, including California and New York, in which they claim numerous violations of federal and state privacy laws for children. Not only are the states seeking billions of dollars from Meta, they're demanding it make changes to Instagram and Facebook, including ending like accounts and infinite scroll. Should Meta ultimately lose a case of this scale, it could force fundamental changes to the way young people experience social media. One state attorney general described the case as the largest consumer protection lawsuit in American history. We will show a jury that Meta concealed what they knew about the harm its products cause young people because looking away was more profitable, said Kentucky Attorney General Russell Coleman. Attorney generals are also in the perfect position to get this done. We did it with the tobacco settlement in the 1990s. We did it with the companies behind the opioid crisis, and we will do it again with Meta. Kentucky and other states are suing Meta, and asking for many more changes to the way Instagram and Facebook operate for young people, too. They want Meta to implement a process of parental verification for teenage users. They want it to change its dopamine-manipulating recommendation algorithms. They wanted to remove many image filters that change one's appearance in photos. They wanted to end autoplay of video content, prohibit the creation of multiple accounts, and end disappearing or ephemeral posts such as Instagram stories. All of these features are central to the current user experience on Meta's platforms. These features are also designed to keep users, including teenagers and children, on the platforms as often and for as long as possible, the states contend. They claim Meta even makes it difficult for young people to use the platform less through things like frequent notifications designed to get young people back on the apps. By allegedly targeting child users, Meta chose to exploit young people in order to hook them on its platforms so it could grow its user base and expand its business. Today, Meta's value on the stock market is about $1.5 trillion. Meta has consistently denied all these claims. We strongly disagree with these allegations and are confident the evidence will show our longstanding commitment to supporting young people, a company spokesperson said. The states are putting their claims to Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers, a chief federal judge in California. She was the judge in the high-profile Elon Musk versus Sam Altman trial and has built a reputation from the bench over the course of nearly 20 years for being incisive and direct. So there's much more to this story, but it will be interesting to see how this trial turns out. Some of the earlier trials have ruled in favor of the individuals making the claims against the big tech companies, and again, you know, being a parent and trying to monitor your child on this media is a challenge. But we have reached the end of our hour together. I want to thank you for listening to the articles I've selected to read to you today. I hope you have found them to be both enjoyable and interesting. I look forward to reading the news with you again in the very near future. Until we have a chance to do that, I hope that life gives you many, many reasons to smile. Be well, my friends.